Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho. Welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on VBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. And by the Rockstar Chronicles Series 1, my new book featuring over 45 intimate conversations with the greatest music legends the world will ever know, available now at bookbaby.com and amazon.com. As guitarist for pop metal band Danger Danger, he toured the world, opening for Kiss and Alice Cooper, sold over a million records worldwide, and had two number one videos on MTV, plus amassing a discography that includes seven solo releases that range from blazing guitar instrumentals to blues, and even a Beatles Elvis Costello-inspired collection of pop tunes. As a session player, he's been highly featured on CDs by drumming legend Simon Phillips, a live CD with Olivia Newton-John, two internationally acclaimed CDs by Kip Winger, recording sessions for Paula Abdul, Paul Stanley, and countless radio and television jingles. He has also played alongside many of his heroes, such as Steve Vai, Joe Satriani, Eric Johnson, Steve Morris, Mike Stern, Ace Frehley, Ted Nugent, and Pierre Van Zandt, as well as some of the fave 60s swinging stars, such as the Beach Boys, Leslie Gore, and Gordon Waller, of Peter and Gordon fame. And he has been consistently voted a top 20 favorite guitarist in most of Japan's rock music magazine readers' polls, as well as being voted Musician of the Year 4 years in a row in the acclaimed Dallas Observer Music Awards. He has also become one of the most respected and sought-out clinicians representing Ivanez guitars touring the world on their behalf. Please welcome legendary guitarist Andy Timmons to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Andy.
Hey, how you doing, brother?
I'm doing good, man. You know,
thanks for having me.
I was listening. Here's what happened. I was listening to Pandora, and they have a station called Robin Trower Radio, and they played Cry for You. So I immediately that's when I immediately emailed you for this interview.
that's sweet. Well, I'm honored to be, aired in the same breath as Robin Trower, one of my heroes. But in fact, I saw Robin on the Embarrassed to Sass Off for the first time only sometime within the last 3 or 4 years. He played the House of Blues here in Dallas, and really, honestly, better than ever as far as any recordings I've heard on. He's clearly, hit the ground running with Cobo Hero, but obviously his early big records pushed aside. But man, the tone and the playing is just—it's improved, man. He's like a fine wine, He's getting better.
He's got his own tone. You've got your own tone. You don't sound like anybody else,
Work in progress, but thank you. I'm a little too close to it. It's hard for me to tell. I'm aware that it's evolving. I think it just kind of comes with having been doing it for so many years, you're bound to, But there's a great guitar player named Mike Stern, you're probably aware of, great in the jazz, healing world. And he once said to me that sometimes it's our limitations that help us create our own thing. I may be trying to have a tone like Hendrix or Eric Johnson or Stevie Ray or whoever, But at some point, you can't help but sound like yourself, you know,
right.
Because of the physiology and all the different types of music you take in, you tend to combine them in such a way. That's why Stevie Ray was so unique. He took all the great blues guys, Albert King and BB and all the Kings, you know, but then, you know, combine them with the Hendrix kind of thing, and it was just unlike anybody that ever really put it together. It became such his own identifiable sound. You can identify the elements and possibly the lineage, but it was in his own, you know, his own DNA at that point.
Well, you've got your own DNA. You know, every time I listen to you, it sounds like you're sitting there right in the recording studio. And that's how clear it is. It's a very, very good, clear, crisp sound. And I love that.
Thank you. I'm trying to improve things as I go. And if that's coming across, well, I'm honored by that. Thank you,
Nick. Oh, you're an incredible guitar player. And I've interviewed a lot of guitar players.
You know, I've noticed there's a few out there. It really is kind of overwhelming, you know. I mean, obviously there's a certain percentage of the truly, you know, highly developed. And you can talk about guys like Jeff Beck or Tommy Emmanuel and just the lifers that have, you know, dedicated their life and have spent the time. But, I mean, even young players that, you know, haven't been doing it for nearly as long, there's a level of proficiency and ability that's just stunning. You know, it doesn't mean you can't be a polished player if you're not, you know, 50 or older, because clearly there's a lot of young players that it's just jaw-dropping.
I agree with you 100%, man. I go on YouTube, and I see these really young players, and they're really kicking ass, you know?
No doubt.
Yeah.
So nobody should be resting. and that's truly the beauty. So, it's less frustrating for me now than it was when I was younger. Only meaning that, the more you learn and the more you gain as far as ability, you just realize you're scratching the surface, and that never stops. You know what I mean? Because there's always the past, you know, to be inspired by. Well, I can keep going back, and I do. I keep going back to Jimi Hendrix or to Barney Kessel or to West or to Ace Frehley for that matter. Anything that inspired me along the way. Or now going further back to Django, who I hadn't really gotten into until like the last 5 or 6 years. He's been waiting, but you know, I finally got there. You know, I wasn't ready. But then, so you've always got the past, but then you've got the present with it. Like you're talking about, there's a level of proficiency and creativity that keeps rising, you know, to a higher and higher level at a younger age group. So, and again, now we have that we didn't have when you know, maybe we were growing up with the internet, you know, now, before somebody to rise to the level to be heard, they had to get a record deal, you know, and that was a whole near possibility, depending on where you lived and what, you know, what you were able to do. But now, anybody with an iPhone in a bedroom in, you know, Kuala Lumpur or Jakarta or McKinney, Texas, if you're really good, you can be. You know, people will find you.
Exactly.
There's a lot of it out there, but, you know, the really quality playing tends to be shared and therefore kind of rises up. And so some of these players that could have gone their whole lives without really having any notoriety, you know, have that ability to shine on the world stage if they truly have something that they've developed that's worthwhile, you know. So that's a pretty heartening thing, but again, the competition and the glutton of so much material can be kind of hard to ride through, but everybody kind of, it's like a level playing field in a way. Everybody has that same opportunity just to really hone their craft and try to get it out there and hopefully touch some people, you know.
You know, great guitarists, though, have this gift. And when I say that, you don't have to learn, you know, and you mentioned this, you don't have to learn theory and you don't have to, you know, sit behind a book and learn all the scales and this and that. The gift is you hear the music and you can play the music. And, you know, I talked to Randy Bachman. That's what he said. He says he hears the music in his head. And what happens with me, I can't do that. For some reason, blues comes out of my guitar. That's the only thing I feel, but I can't go and listen to a song and just, you know, replicate it. It's difficult.
Yeah. Well, there's some things that come with repetition and work, and there may be people that have certain innate abilities, you know, maybe kind of they're born with it in a way, but believe, was just pure tenacity and stick-to-itiveness, as Bugs Bunny once said. I love Randy Bogdan, by the way. He's just one of my all-time favorite big BSU fans.
Good guy.
What a sound, what a tone, what a songwriter. Love everything about that guy. You don't have to know everything to play great. Maybe what you're referencing is when I talk about the people that feel like they need to learn all the scales and all the theory. It's helpful at a certain point, but what's really important are the fundamentals, the foundations of just the basics. And that's, like, I always reference Stevie Ray in that regard. I never knew Stevie, but had we had a conversation, I could just about guess that he wouldn't have known a mode from anything else. But he had the basics so well together, the blues, blues scale, pentatonic scale, and he just kind of played it better than anybody else. He played just all those great, basic things, but just with such a fire and authenticity, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
It was so pure. Not to say that somebody with a lot of knowledge can't sound just as genuine as authentic. Of course they can. So you're saying, when you play, you're getting just the blues out.
Getting the blues.
Okay. that's all right. But what you're referencing too is, like, I remember totally having this epiphany when I was, like, I don't know, maybe 10 or 11, 12 years old. And there wasn't much guitar on TV. If you got lucky on a variety show, they'd have a band like Ed Sullivan or whatever, but there was Hee Haw, right?
Yeah.
So you had Buck Owens and Roy Clark, and every now and then they would cut Roy Clark loose on a solo feature.
Roy Clark was amazing.
He was like the first kind of virtuoso guitar player I've ever seen.
He was great.
And I remember thinking that this guy could just probably play anything that he wants to, like, he
would
play anything ever. Just the freedom that he seemed to have, And so, I guess that now that I've been playing for 50 some odd years, I'm not there, but it's getting a little easier, but it's a long way to go, man. But I'm so happy to be enjoying the journey. I'm enjoying the journey more than ever now.
Yeah.
I'm not as frustrated by not being able to do things.
Right, right.
As I might have been, or envious of other players. I'm finally getting comfortable with being me, if that makes sense. And that's sometimes a hard place to get to at any point in your life, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
But in that regard, I'm feeling a little more comfortable, but I'm also feeling more inspired and just, hungrier than ever to keep improving and just trying to, because I just feel like we're scratching the surface with the potential of the electric guitar and the level of expression. I think Jeff Beck has raised the bar significantly throughout his career. And guys like Pat Metheny, just anybody that has the command of the instrument, like some of these greats, it's real inspiring.
Guess who I'm talking to next week? John McLaughlin.
Well, there's a guy. now you're just name dropping, right? Well, I'm glad you haven't run out of really good guys. I figure maybe if you got to meet, you ran out of all the really good guys. Clearly, there's a few good ones left. If you haven't thought, that's amazing. Well, I mean, just what a career he's had.
Yeah, he's something.
When I was going to school at the University of Miami, the drum instructor was a guy named Steve Rucker. He'd just been to see John McLaughlin.
Right.
And he just looked at me with a kind of sly grin and said, "He knows something we don't."
Exactly. He does.
He knows a lot that I don't. he's a highly evolved human. So that'll be a fun conversation. That's awesome.
Well, I'll mention that you want to collaborate with him. How's that?
There you go. Sure, absolutely. Yeah, what a dream, man. He's a phenomenal musician, absolutely.
Yeah. We got something in common. My wife is from Henderson, Kentucky.
Ah, okay, right across the river.
Right across the river, yeah. Yeah, you're from Evansville. I know Evansville very well.
Okay.
From
what year were you starting to visit Evansville? How long?
Gosh, probably the early 80s, maybe.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So I was there. I think I moved to Miami in 83.
That's when I got married, 83.
Well, I'll be darned.
Yeah.
Well, how about that?
Do you remember Don Mattingly's restaurant?
Very much so, yeah. That would have been on, was it Morgan?
Yeah, that was a cool place, man. I used to love to eat there.
I had to honestly say that I never got to go there. Now, the one thing, Evansville had one job and that was to keep Serbeat open. Serbeat was like, I think they might have been scattered across the country, but a pretty small chain, but they were like an Arby's type.
Right, right.
So to speak. But it was infinitely better. It was the best business. They finally closed down. I was heartbroken. You hate to lose those kind of one-of-a-kind or
I know.
Eateries from your childhood, you know what I mean? It's what all about.
My wife wants to know if you ever went, there was a club that she went to back in the disco days called Funky's at, in Evansville.
I played there many, many times.
You're kidding me.
Taylor Bay.
Yep.
And the Taylor Bay Band, we were kind of one of the local hero bands.
Right.
A lot of play. There was a radio station called KC103. They were based in Henderson, actually.
Right.
And, we had a couple of records we put out. And, so we had a lot of local airplay. Played some of the big shows there, and Funkies, and then Funkies 2.
Yep.
So there weren't a whole lot of places to go. So
no.
Yeah, if she experienced nightlife in Evansville, that's probably one of the places.
That was her hangout.
There you go. Wow. You know, there's probably many other Evansville haunts we could reminisce about, but that might be beyond the listenership here.
Yeah, Evansville's a cool place, though. You know, they shot that movie, A League of Their Own, there at Bossy Field.
That's right.
Yeah.
Bossy Field, yeah. I saw many an Evansville triplets game in the early 70s there.
Mm-hmm.
My friends across the street, the Romans family, Jim Romans and his sons, Keith and Rusty, they would take me and go to the triplets game. Yeah, so we were a farm team for the Twins.
Oh, really?
The Evansville triplets.
Huh.
But yeah, we had some great players come through there. And it was just great going to that old school, you know, ball field.
Right.
You know, it was really... really great.
Yep.
Americana, you know.
I used to go to Evansville a lot because Henderson was a little boring.
Well, you got to go to the big city. it's like when they were in Mayberry, they go to Mount Pilot.
Right, right? Main it's Street.
Like you're coming from Mayberry over to Mount Pilot.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
There we go.
Andy, I want to give your album, Theme from a Perfect World, 5 stars, man. I loved it.
Dude, thank you very much.
It was incredible.
I
really enjoyed it.
Is that out of 100 or what is that?
No, 5 out of 5.
Okay, you can tell I take compliments really well, but thank you. I'm very, very proud of that record, and it, seems like it keeps seeping out slowly but surely.
Some of my favorite tracks, Theme from a Perfect World, of course.
Yeah.
You know, excellent guitar work on that. And I love how it switches gears, you know?
That was meant to kind of be, I was a big Todd Rundgren and Utopia fan.
Yep.
And so the title of the record is a Thinly Veiled Reference, you know, Theme from a Perfect World, Utopia.
Yep.
And there was this track called Theme from Utopia that was on, I think, the first Utopia record. It was a lengthy, kind of prog type track that went through all these different kind of jams. Utopia was very Mahavishnu influenced. It was Todd kind of going contrapuntally to his pop career. He was, you know, he's also a musician. He wanted to play it, right? You know, he's been writing all these kind of proggy, odd time signature jams with these melodic pop sections.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, it's a beautiful guitar work from Todd. So that was really inspiring, you know, influential to me in my youth. Because I had an older brother, my brother John, that was a big Todd fan, so I got to hear a lot of this a lot growing up. And so that tune is kind of a combination. It's a little bit Thaney, it's a little Todd, it's a little Who, you know, it's just got all these kind of, I don't know, just a grab bag of stuff that I love and then the band loves, and so it's a fun thing to put together.
Well, YouTube described it, some of your fans said it was godlike. Yeah. It was godlike. And another one says it takes you on a magical journey. You know, it's a great song.
Well, that's very sweet, man. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the intention with a lot of instrumental music. At least just for me, you know, if I'm writing it and performing it, that's the beauty of it. It's you know, it can take the listener kind of wherever they want to go, but it's up to them to kind of interpret what it makes them feel and what emotions they want to attach to that. You know, because the written language or the song or spoken language tends to be finite to a certain degree. I mean, it could be poetic, it could be abstract in the villainesque way. But music can go a lot deeper, I think, because it's not really constrained to just specific words, even though it's a little tougher to get the general public to relate to non-lyrical music, I think, sometimes. But for those willing to kind of participate,
right,
really get deep into the listener, But it can really be a deeply emotional thing. And so some people are being taken by that. That's the deepest honor that I can hope for, really. for us of an older age, I mean, that's what music was. We'd lay in our bedroom, you know, and just stare at the album cover and just hear this music washing over us. And really, we're really involved in participant in it. So it's nice to know that some people are still engaging on that level, because we get the feeling that it's becoming such a quick fix society.
Right.
Because, you know,
right.
They might, I love this, but, you know, forward on after a minute.
Yeah, exactly.
You just want to go to the next, whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's nice to know that there's still people that are really taking the time and going on a journey with the band, with the writer, and with the, you know, with the melodist, or whoever you want to call. I consider myself the singer in the band, though I'm not singing on the guitar.
Well, you know, I think it's genius when you make people, you know, think about memories and things like that in just an instrumental,
yeah.
You know, only instrumental. It's like, you know, Jeff Beck, Diamond Dust does that for me. Every time I hear Diamond Dust, I go into another world, you know?
Well, I think there's certainly some of those, the music that connects with you at a younger age.
Right.
Music that obviously happens throughout your life. It can really be an anchor and almost a trigger sometimes. You can hear a piece of music that if it was prominent at a certain time in your life, you know, positive or negative, it can really trigger some emotion just from that association.
It does.
You know? But clearly there's music that will just take you places, even without that. But there's certain songs you can hear that go, it just puts you back. I can even smell sometimes.
Exactly, me too.
If it's a piece of, you know, if it's a piece of music from a certain time in my life, or, you know, or a certain place I lived, or with certain people, or in a particular environment. It's a really strong, strong groove that it cuts in our memory, you know, and that makes us feel that.
Well, you know, one track.
Really incredibly powerful, isn't it?
What one powerful track that you have that makes people think about memories, and it's a very powerful track to people, is "On Your Way, Sweet Soul."
Oh yeah, yeah. That was kind of taken on a bit of a life. You know, I've been putting up a lot of videos. I do this monthly thing. I have a subscription website called GuitarExperience.net, and every month I feature a different track for my record, and I play it, and then I kind of teach everything about it. A friend of mine transcribes it, but the basic just performance of the song I'll put up on the internet. You don't have to have a subscription for it. You just, you know, hear me and see me play the song. But that one's like, I think, over a million views already.
Yeah,
it's just kind of, it's really struck a chord.
It really has.
No pun intended, but yeah, it's really kind of resonating with me. So that's very humbling and it's very appreciated, you know.
Sanctuary, another cool track. I think you did it live once or in a studio on YouTube. Very cool song.
Thank you.
Yeah. What about Lift Us Up, Something Wicked This Way Comes? Explain that one.
Sometimes, you know, like songs like On Your Way, Sweet Soul, that was in response to a very specific thing that was happening, and Next Voice You Hear was written very specifically. Now, Lift Us Up, that riff just kind of came one day.
Mm-hmm.
But it reminded, we've been playing a lot in Europe. We've been playing a lot in Italy and Spain. And sometimes the crowd would erupt in just like these random, you know, soccer chants. Like that was their way of showing their appreciation.
Exactly.
It was whatever they yelled at the soccer match, they would get into these cool things. And sometimes we jam along with them. Like, I'd find what key they were in and we would jam. So that melody, I just kind of envisioned a crowd singing it. Just kind of sounded like something that could really lift the crowd up, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's a, you know, it's a pretty dark ending, you know, just, so yeah, but it's kind of a two-part tune. Mm-hmm. The title, Something Wicked This Way Comes, I think is a Ray Bradbury, book title. My oldest brother Mark is a philosophy professor, really into science fiction in the 50s growing up, and Ray Bradbury and Rod Serling were his favorite writers.
Me too.
So, Something Wicked This Way Comes, I think that's the one with the lightning rod salesman. So, that's even though I don't even think if I ever read the book, it's been so long I forget, but the title was just such a powerful image.
It is.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, that time, you know, the world's always going through potential darkness at every corner. So, you know, as much as we want to lift people up, we have to be aware of reality as well. So I think that's kind of it's a very yin and yang kind of thing.
Yeah, I want to mention Theme from a Perfect World is almost a concept album in itself, you know, to the song. One song just tells it all, you know, which is really incredible.
Well, Mike Dane is my bass player and engineer, co-producer.
Yep, so, had a good band there.
We've been working together since 1988.
Right.
So, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes we'll have a particular, you know, kind of direction for a record.
Right.
And sometimes we just kind of have to wait for it to appear depending on how songs are coming along and turning out. We have to kind of figure out how things work together. So they weren't composed to be part of an overall theme. They all are driven by the same ethos of, you know, a certain sonic integrity, a certain authenticity, and the real desire to record something that will last and that will move people, you know. So, on the surface, it is a guitar record. At the same time, it's very much not. It's not a guitar record based on, I can't wait to get to the solo.
Right.
In fact, like a song like Sanctuary, there really is no solo. It's just, it didn't need one. It was just, this is okay, this is a song the way it is, and why would I mess with that? Just, okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm very proud compositionally how things have evolved with the band, you know, with what I'm doing. Just in that, yeah, it's not about, hey, what can I do to show off the limits of my abilities? It's, okay, you know, that may not be part and parcel to some of the things that take to execute whatever the end result, goal is, but it's really about that. Is this something that I'm going to want to listen to and I'm hoping other people want to listen to, not just after they get over the high wire act or whatever technique that's interesting. You know, the novelty of that would wear off.
Right.
You know, if it's a good song, that's going to last.
Well, I think that's why you're so successful. It's because you think that way, you know?
It's hard to quantify the word successful, but at this stage of my life, I do realize it's not necessarily about a record sales thing or a household name thing. But I will say that on some level, I feel successful in that I tend to be, you know, accepted by my peers and a lot of the players that I respect.
Yep. Exactly right.
You know, can appreciate what I do. It's not at some level, you know, it's like that's some of the best kind of success, I think. It's just knowing that you're appreciated and respected. Regardless of the commercial thing. You know, when I had my time with Danger Danger, I quickly learned that, okay, I thought this was the Holy Grail. I thought this, being in a major label, I'm on MTV, that always kind of seemed like the mysterious, unattainable thing. So then I was in the belly of it, and I thought, okay, this is nothing to do with what really makes me happy, which is just being myself and wanting to create the music that's in my heart.
Amen.
Not being part of a larger, you know, corporate business. I mean, again, at some point, economics have to enter the equation, and now I have to figure out a way of making a living with my instruments, since this is what I've chosen and committed to do. But that's not what I'm good at. Somehow, by some blessing along the way, the lights are still on. You know, I'm able to support my family and still do what I love to do. But it's not always easy. So, but again, if you quantify success as far as financial gain and all that, I'm not sure where I fit in the pie chart there, but on the just personal gratification and acceptance and love, I it's from a much smaller crowd as opposed to having a top 10 record or, you know, touring 300 days a year. It's a different level, but at the same time, it's a very sincere, caring group of people that seem to accept me and want to hear what I do. So I couldn't feel more successful than that. I mean, that's, to me, it's just really the greatest thing. Having kind of experienced the Danger Danger thing was kind of a different level of fame and notoriety. And it was, I'm not going to lie, it was a blast. I mean, when I was 16. I was 13, I should say. You know, which is unimaginable, unattainable fantasy world that there was. Okay, this is, wow, okay, fantastic. But just on the personal and the business side, it's like, okay, this isn't what I want.
Yeah.
So where I sit now, and again, just having somebody like you on the other end of the phone, doing something that I've, you know, worked so hard on, that's success. That's okay, you know. Okay, I'll play some more gigs, I'll teach some more guitar lessons,
right,
hopefully sell some more records, but yeah, that's a pretty great thing out there. So
well, look, you're on the Robin.
Be a part of that, man.
Yeah,
really appreciate it.
You're on the Robin Trower channel. I don't pick the music that's in there, just Robin Trower, and they've got Johnny Lang. You're part of with Johnny Lang, Bonamassa, Jeff Beck, Stevie Ray Vaughan, and Buckethead. Those are some of the guys that are. You know, that's who they meshed you with.
Amazing players in that list. Well, that's pretty good. I mean, and that's kind of the beauty too of a thing like Pandora, where it's like.
Yep.
Like on Amazon, if you like this, you know, you might want people who bought this might want to buy this. It's kind of like it's the digital version of your favorite record store.
Exactly.
When you were a kid.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, or like I always talk about Pee Wee's Big Adventure when Pee Wee walks in the magic shop. Pee Wee, we got the. He knows exactly. He knows Pee Wee. You know, he knows what he's gonna do. So he's gonna show him. That's what the internet. It's what the internet now is. It's exactly. Like it's like I used to know at the record store. It's like, oh, you're a fan of this band. You gotta check this out. It's just came out.
Yeah.
You know, so there's still brick and mortar out there. Like I said, I've got my my guitar shop here in McKinney called the Guitar Sanctuary.
Cool.
And my best friend George Fuller owns the place. Runs the place. It's really a really great shop. And one of the main guys is Brian Meter. He's my Pee Wee's Magic Shop guy. There's so many pedals and guitar gadgets. And I can't keep up with it. But I know as soon as I walk in, he's gonna go, Andy, you gotta check this new thing out. Because he knows what I dig, and so he's kind of my filter, you know.
I saw some of your setups.
Of that, but we have digital versions of that too, like Pandora. You know, it's like a lot of people. I think a lot of people have discovered my stuff. Things like that,
mm-hmm.
or on YouTube, you know, as well, because you know, like that version of "Cry for You," the live version of "Cry for You" with Simon Phillips, you know, was one of the first videos I had that was so widely viewed. And again, it was just a gig that it was professionally recorded, but never it wasn't officially released. So somebody bootlegged it and uploaded it, and I have a lot of my career to thank for it. But that's the video that got spread a lot and became. But then YouTube became our MTV. That was the way people
were
finding music and people sharing it. Like, oh wow, you're a fan of Satriani or whoever.
Right.
Check this guy out, right? So that it's all a cool thing with how it's all kind of organically, you know, helping other artists, you know.
But isn't it cool to be in danger in that kind of different kind of genre, and then now you're with amongst the Jeff Becks and the Stevie Ray Vaughan. I mean, that's kind of cool, isn't it?
Well, no, I mean, it's funny because I was kind of doing that before Danger Danger. I mean, I was already on that path.
Okay.
I started off as a 70s rock guy. I was 13 years old, like I said, going to see Kiss and Rush and Midget and all the arena rock, you know, Midwest bands, right, or coming through the Midwest, I should say. But then I progressed into getting, I was, you know, taking lessons when I was 16, and that guy was showing me, you know, the jazz world, and I started hearing guys like, you know, Larry Carlton, The Thing, and Mike Stern, and so I was going down a whole different path, and by the time I went to Danger Danger, I'd already been, you know, a classical major for 2 years in college, and I was a jazz major in Miami. So I could have easily gotten the call. In fact, I was offered the Tower of Power gig at the same time as the Danger Danger gig.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. So there's that fork in the road. You know, it's like, okay, you could go one way, you go to the Bay, or you go to New York City. And so I kind of, the rock and roll, light, you know, the shining lights of MTV where I guess were shining my way, and I chose that path. But as soon as that kind of had its day, I went back to Texas and finished what became Your Ecstasy. But a lot of those tracks were done either before or during Danger Danger. So the first instrumental recording I did was called It's Getting Better, and that's on my Your Ecstasy CD. That was done in 1988, which was a demo, which is the track that actually got me the gig at Danger Danger. But you can already hear, you know, there's a kind of a Jeff Beck kind of influence riff, and it's kind of like a bebop jazz. jazz section and kind of a heavy metal, McAlpine, English, you know, so the guy's already there in a way, you know, but it just continues to grow, but it's like doing that gig or doing, you know, Olivia John's gig or Simon Phillips, it's all about, you know, when it's my gig, I'll do what I do, you know, but then sometimes you kind of morph into to do what's right for other situations. Hopefully, you know, retaining my essence or whatever my musicality is, but sometimes it's about being a team player, sometimes it's more about, okay, this is my time, this is my heart, you know, and you let that shine in that way.
Well, I think your Cry For You, which is still my all-time favorite, is your kind of... I had Eric Johnson on the show a while back, and I think I think Cry For You is your Cliffs of Dover, maybe.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's a little slower, not as hard to play. Thank you. That is easily, you know, one of my most... That and Electric Gypsy, probably my most requested.
Electric
song.
Gypsy, yeah.
It's one of those tunes, too, that I can play differently every night, and it's always fresh, and it always... It's cathartic. It's just, you know, originally written as a, you know, missing my girlfriend when I moved from Texas to New York to join Danger Danger. But the song has lasted a lot longer than the relationship here. But now it's just kind of a cathartic, you know, whatever I want to plug into, whatever's happening in my life or somebody else's life. It's a great platform for expression. It's in D minor, the saddest of all three. So there you go.
I admire all the guys, people you play with, and, which is really cool, is Olivia Newton-John. You were her music director, right?
I was her guitar music director for 15 years.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite parts of my career. So obviously, people that know me from Danger Danger or Simon or my own stuff might chalk their head sideways, but it's one of my most gratifying relationships. She's just an amazing person and an incredible singer and musician. Being in the position of being music director, I got to help form the band, and we had a bunch of other people that felt the same way I did. There's a lot of respect for her, a lot of respect for the music. And that's key in doing a gig like that, you know. You don't want a bunch of folks just happy to have a gig but don't really give a shit, you know.
Yeah.
People need to care, and that was really important to me to find folks. And not everybody lasted, you know. There was a couple that didn't last more than a tour, but, you know, it's down to the people that you're with. If I'm going to leave home, especially after my son was born 16 years ago, if I'm going to leave home, it's better be something that I'm, A, really happy doing, or B, really happy doing. There's no other reason. I mean, we all need to tour, we all need to gig.
Sure.
But, you know, I've been offered gigs along the way from some folks. It's a pretty, you know, what would be considered high-level gigs that people would die for, but knowing personalities or reputations, like, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean, that at a certain point in my life, I was like, okay. Yeah, if I was 20, I might have said, but no. I'm not saying that to infer any type of greatness on my part. I'm just saying that, you know, that's the important stuff. It's really got to resonate with the people that you're with. She was just one of the people that you just love to be around and just treated people so lovely. You know, if you met her, you feel like you know you're known forever. So I saw her do lots of good in the world, and she still does. She uses her power for good, as I say.
Yeah, I was a top 40 disc jockey back in the 70s. So I dug, you know, hit radio, you know, and people that put out the hits, you know. So I, you know, and I played Olivia Newton-John on the air, and and I saw you. Did you play with Liz?
The interesting thing about her career was that she started off almost kind of country.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, if you love me, let me know.
Right.
And then I honestly love you, and have you never been mellow. It's just kind of easy gold kind of pop. But then some Greek stuff. But then early 80s, like Magic and Xanadu, there used to be a lot of, you know, in her set later, we would do a lot of kind of standard jazz and seductive rock. And
she's a cool lady. You know, I always loved her.
A lovely, she is. She's a truly sweet person. And, but yeah, just the range of ability musically is stunning.
I was supposed to interview her, but then she got, you know, sick again. you know.
Yeah, so she had this, she the first battle with cancer was in the early 90s, and she really retired at that point. So when I started working with her, she had just kind of gotten back out, did a few shows, and was enjoying it. Then, okay, let's put together a U.S.-based group, and that's when I jumped in. But that was through Simon Phillips, because it was her management at Fitzgerald Hartley, which managed Toto through all the, most of their career. So it was just one of those word of mouth, hey, Olivia needs a guitar player. So I was like, I know a guy.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's awesome.
I had this message on my machine, like, hey, do you talk to me with Olivia needs a job? I'm like,
yeah.
I don't know, what are the hours, right? You know.
That's so cool.
But that's how it happened. It just kind of led into this really lengthy, great, you know, relationship with her. It's thoroughly enjoyable. So I was, over those years, I was also doing Simon stuff, and I was also doing my stuff, but everybody, you know, she only did a couple of months out of the year, just sprinkled in here and there, and Simon would do his thing in Europe, and I had time to do my own thing. So it all worked really well. But my own thing started getting busier and busier, and I had to kind of thin it out.
Yeah.
So, but of course now I'm just, everything's at home, so I've been doing these live gigs on stage. I do two gigs every Saturday, one at 2 p.m. Central and one at 8 p.m. Central. And so I've done over 30 shows now since the COVID lockdown started at the end of March.
Huh.
And so that's been a godsend. So I can, right where I'm sitting now in my studio, I can fire up. I've learned enough about, you know, getting a good lighting and sound, and so I'm like running concerts out of my house, and I'm loving it. I mean, of course, I want to be on stage with my band and in front of a live audience, but I can't do that for now. I'm going to keep playing. And
good.
Got a nice, you know, core of fans that come out to every gig, and it's been a great situation. Now I'm glad I'm so fortunate to have some way of keeping going while we're waiting to see if they'll be able to get back out and do it.
Yeah, I hope it's soon, man.
I miss the music. Family, everybody's sick. I mean, we gotta be intelligent with it. So,
yeah,
you know, let's hope it's sooner than later. But yeah, let's do it the right way.
Exactly.
So whatever that might be.
Exactly. I want to mention some of the great songs from Danger. Danger to my audience. Bang Bang. Feels Like Love. Naughty Naughty. Huh. One Step from Paradise.
That's all the first record. Yeah, that was. Yeah, that was a fun time. It's a whole different age. I mean, that was 1989 when that record came out.
Yeah.
So it was definitely in the Bon Jovi, Def Leppard, you know, pantheon of, I prefer to call it melodic rock, but people will call it hair band.
Hair band.
There might have been some Aquanaut and Aussie Scrunch involved. I'm not sure. There's plenty of damning photographic evidence on the Google. So have fun with that.
That's funny.
Yeah, it happens.
It does. And sure. I want to mention your work with playing Sergeant Pepper's. Oh my goodness.
Oh man.
And you did that, didn't you? You did that without any direction, really, right? Didn't you just kind of? Did you improvise or?
The whole concept kind of came from I was touring in Europe with my trio, and I was in Italy, and our tour promoter Riccardo Capelli. You know, I had the first thing I'd arranged was a trio version of a Strawberry Fields Forever. And every night, you know, he was noticing how well the song went. I was just people in general are Beatle fans, and they liked the version we were doing. He said, next time you come back, you should do all night of Beatles. And I'm like, there's no way I could pull that off. This one song's working, but I'm like, But it kind of planted the seed, and I started, you know, just kind of every now and then I tried, like, maybe Help or In My Life. But the next song that kind of came out of my fingers was Lucy in the Sky. And so then at some point after kind of, it became a hobby, because from the Revolution record, I started doing arrangements of my songs where chords and melody were being played simultaneously. We did the Revolution record without any overdubs. There was one guitar, bass, and drums. Zero overdubs on the entire record. So for the next record, Theme from a Perfect World, I intended it to do it the same way, even though we ended up overdubbing on that record. The Pepper arrangements I was doing was, okay, let me see if I can replicate everything that I hear in my head of that song in one linear performance to where, if and when I record this, no overdubs. So by doing it that way, instead of trying to track it up and try to emulate every individual sound, that could have been done. But I think it's way more interesting because, and it is true that except for the middle section of Within You, Without You, guitar performance of each song is replicating how the song kind of plays in my head, whether it's what's to the fore, you know, how can I represent represent all these pieces in a linear fashion? What's more important at that moment? Is it the melody of the vocalist or a guitar chord or a sound effect like the chicken clucking?
Right.
Or the sitar, whatever it might be. And so that again made it really interesting because it wasn't always correct. Mostly, you know, but, you know, some things were a little askew, but it's how I remember it. It's how it's been kind of ingrained. The middle section of Within You Without You, I failed on because I never understood it when I was a kid. It turns out it's been 5/4, which I didn't realize. So it was an odd time signature. It was very complicated sitar and orchestra dialogue. But so when I recorded the original track with Mitch Marine in the studio of my band, when we got to that section, I'd done the whole thing over the groove of Tomorrow Never Knows, like they had done in the Cirque du Soleil thing, that mashup they did, I thought was so brilliant. It was hard for me to hear that song without that. It just worked great. So when we got to that section, that middle section, I just had Mitch keep the Ringo Tomorrow Never Knows drum group going. All this Hendrix psychedelic freak out guitar over it. That'll be fine. But when I listen to the playback notes, I'm like, no, that's not cutting it. I got to learn that original thing. But I had to go, I had to really transcribe, I had to go. Because that was the one track I didn't listen to nearly as much. That was, I would have skipped over that because it was too far ahead of me, you know. Now I think it's like one of the most beautiful tracks on the record. It's a stunning piece of work. But that is it. So that whole record, there's no overdub. It's meant to be bass guitars, one guitar, bass guitar dubs it, but the guitar trying to replicate all that it can of the essence of each song.
I think it's amazing. It's a brilliant album.
Thank you.
Has Paul or Ringo listened to it?
You know I got a copy of the Ringo, but I highly doubt he listened to it. I just don't think these guys really need to talk about any more Beatles. it would be a dream come true. I especially think that Paul, like that's my version of, She's Reading Home, I think is particularly poignant. You know, I really spent a lot of time trying to capture the emotion of that song. I get it. There's so many Beatle covers out there.
Yeah.
If you happen to hear it accidentally, who knows, you might dig it. But I haven't heard from either one of them. Ken Scott, I did get a copy to, who was an engineer with the Beatles there and the White Album on. He got a copy of it and really dug it. So I was heartened to know that someone in the Beatles circle gave it a thumbs up. But so far, I don't know about Ringo or Paul.
Well, send me the MP3.
Yeah.
If you can send me the MP3 of the album, you know, if you can, and I'll send it to Ringo's PR people. I know them.
Oh, that's cool. Well, thank you, man.
Yeah.
They
invited me to one of their shows. I was trying to get an interview with Ringo, but he was, you know, it's kind of hard to get, but they did invite me to the show, and I covered the show.
That's so great. Well, thank you.
I'll send it to him.
I appreciate it.
I'll definitely send it to him, for sure.
That's awesome.
Maybe he'll include you in the All-Star Band one day.
I've seen many shows. I'm friends with Steve Lukather for years.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Gotten to go hang out a few times, and Ringo's been very, very cool with me. If you do get a chance to meet him, just every bit of the liver puddling in you would help you with me. He's just very witty and very, very warm person. Very, very sweet.
Yeah, and he just turned 80.
I know. Did you watch that YouTube special that you did a little birthday celebration?
I did.
That's a lot of video contributions from a bunch of different folks. It was a great version of Come Together that he did the drums on with Sheila E.
Yep.
Singing it like, it was really, really good.
That was cool. Yeah.
If you haven't seen that, I highly recommend it.
You actually reunited with Danger back in 2014, right?
That is true. And also, we just reunited the last 4 Saturdays. I've done a Danger stage it show, and they all came on and were on the message board. We actually did a series of, let me think about it, maybe 5 shows.
Uh-huh.
The impetus was a festival in Europe called Firefest in Birmingham, UK, had invited us to headline. They've been doing these melodic rock music festivals, and this was going to be their last year, and they wanted the original 5 guys to reunite and help be the headliners, and we agreed to do it, you know.
That's awesome.
They continued on without me after things kind of fell apart in the early 90s. They picked up the pieces and continued on with a variety of, you know, a couple different guitar players, and Paul Lane was singing for a while because Paul Lane came back. So they get out and do gigs every now and then. There's a great guitar player from Sweden named Rob Marcello that comes and plays with him. I call him Mini Me, but he's taller than me. He's still got the really long blonde hair. So he's a phenomenal player.
Yeah.
But yeah, we did five shows. We did three in Japan, one in New York. It's kind of a warm-up show, and then that festival in the UK. And it was great fun, man. It's amazing how once you've been in a band with a bunch of guys like that, even though we were together maybe 3-4 years at the most, it's an intense time because you're spending all this time on the road together. Mm-hmm. You know each other better than some family at that point. So once we get back together, it's like not a day has passed, and laughing at all the same jokes we were laughing at 30 years ago. So it's a brotherhood for sure. It's a good, the bad, and ugly,
Andy, here's a question I ask everybody, and I get some very interesting answers. It's going to be tough for you because you know a lot of people, but if you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie, to perform, collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
Well, I would say get McCartney and Elvis Costello in a room together again and be with them.
Mm-hmm.
I was just listening to McCartney and Elvis wrote a bunch of songs together during the Flowers in the Dirt era.
Right.
McCartney. And the demos had been bootleg years before, which I had a copy of, but I think they finally resurfaced again on the Flowers in the Dirt reissue. And McCartney and Elvis singing and writing together is every bit as strong, in some ways stronger, dare I say, than Lennon McCartney. Just the Elvis's depth lyrically is just so incredible, and it's a Paul to have that sparring partner again. I think he's done plenty of great on his own, no argument. But when he and Elvis were together, you could tell that it's like, he had to step up his game. And I'm sure Elvis felt similarly. But I guess I'm there at the tip of my load at the moment because I was just listening to that stuff yesterday. Just thinking how great it was. But yeah, I just would love to play something with Ringo and Paul, and then put Elvis in there, and I'm a happy guy, Or if I could play some standards with Chet Baker, that would be, he's my favorite jazz, musician of all time. Just his pure, the pureness of his melodic intent.
Yeah.
It's so special. I wouldn't mind hanging with Jimmy either.
That's a popular one.
Jimmy. This is an impossible question, but
Here's some answers you would have never thought of. Robin Trower says James Brown, and Petula Clark says Pink Floyd.
Wow, there you go. Petula Floyd, right there.
That blew me away.
That's pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder what Olivia Newton-John would have said. It's probably something off the wall.
Let me think. She was a big Julie London fan.
Julie London, really?
Julie London was a big influence on her early career. Uh-huh. Like everybody, she was a big Beatles fan. But she knew those guys. She was, her boyfriend was in the Shadows, Cliff Richard's band. And so she has a great memory of being at Paul McCartney's Cavendish apartment while he was working on Lady Madonna. And that's pretty cool.
That is cool.
But she's known a few folks over the years. But that's an interesting question, though.
How's she doing? Have you talked to her?
She's doing great. We're in fairly constant touch. Texting or emails, and she's doing great.
Good, good.
Over the last maybe a year ago, there was a scare.
Yeah.
That the cancer come back again. But as far as I know, at this time, she's doing great. It's in remission. And she's a strong lady, I've seen her just fight through so many things with complete grace and dignity. It's inspiring,
She's one of my favorite people.
People would ask me if what's she really like? I'm like, it's like kind of better than you could imagine.
Right.
So better than you think. It's just, she's just real deal. There's no air of, bull or anything. She's just straight up and real. I love her a lot, man.
Two people that are like that are legends. Petula Clark's just like that. She's in her 80s now. She's awesome. And
she was with Olivia. We were somewhere, I want to say, it might have been South Korea.
Uh-huh.
We were in a hotel somewhere, and Olivia came down and said, course, it's a platoon of clients. Like, yep. Are you kidding me? You call me? You're like, what? She happened to be in town for something. I was so bummed.
She's so cool.
That's great you got to chat with her.
Yeah, she lives in Switzerland. And the other one is, believe it or not, I talked with Connie Francis, which...
Wow.
She's a legend, but a lot of people don't remember her, which is very sad.
very huge, absolutely.
Yeah. Another cool lady.
Yeah.
She lives in Lauderdale.
Well, you all get to talk to some legends.
It's a lot of fun. it's a lot of fun, and you're in that list.
Well.
Yes, you are.
I appreciate that. You're very kind.
Andy, what's going on now? You got another album in the works, or what's going on?
Yeah, there's several things. There's a record that's just finished, Greg Bissonette and his brother Matt Bissonette.
Oh, awesome.
Greg, the drummer and bass player.
Yeah.
That I've known for many years. Of course, Greg now has been touring with Ringo for many years, and Matt's out with Elton John when Elton tours. So those two, along with Wally Ginko on keyboards and Mike Medina on percussion, I've done a record together, and the band is called The Red Coats.
Okay.
And it's kind of a play on words like Yellow Jackets. It's kind of a fusion meets pop group. You'll understand it when you finally hear it, but Matt is an amazing songwriter and singer, and has done many records like that in the past. You know, he had a thing called The Mustard Teeth back in the 90s.
Right.
It was very Beatles-esque, and of course, Greg is a big Beatles guy.
Yep.
So there's that element to it, but there's a bunch of guys that can play high-level fusion stuff. So it's kind of appeals to fans of all that. So that'll come out in November, and I'm in the mix mode now for records that Greg's a blues guitar player out of he's out of Florida actually. He was real with Derek Chuck, his name is Josh Smith.
Okay.
And he's out in LA now, and he invited me to his studio to record a record in January. It's kind of a side project apart from the ATB. Why don't you come out to my studio, write some tunes and we'll write some songs together.
Right.
Just record. I thought that sounds like fun. Just do something I'm not so precious about. Let him produce and pick. He can pick the players. I'm just going to show up and, do my thing. And so it's turning out incredible. It's going to be called Electric Truth. And I'm not sure when it'll be out, but it might be likely November, December. And then ongoing, there's an Andy Timmons band record that eventually Mike and I will hopefully be in a room together to finish. But it starts with that one. But we've got over 20 tracks waiting to be finished, so we just got to pick the right ones and move forward.
Well, I got a feeling.
Like I said, I got this instructional website, the Guitar Experience, and I'm going to keep doing these stage shows until they tell me to stop, which hopefully they don't.
Yeah, talk a little bit about the instructional. You got instructional videos, and what else is going on?
It's a subscription site that you do a monthly or a yearly thing, and it's already got over, it must be 25, 26 songs of the month that you've done.
I went in.
So there's the playthrough videos, but then there's about anywhere between an hour and a half to 2 hours I spend on each song showing people every part of what I'm playing and
the
concepts behind it. You know, maybe the recording or how the song was written, the gear that was used. I have a friend of mine in Brazil, Alexander Calamari, transcribes the songs. And so it's very accurately notated and tabbed, so people can sit there and read it. But also they have me on screen showing them how to do it. So, but in addition to that, we post a bunch of old videos on there that aren't on YouTube. And there's a photo gallery, but instead of just writing, oh, here's me, with Boy George, or here's me with Ringo, or whatever, I actually narrate and tell the story behind every picture.
Mm-hmm.
And what that person means to me, and what the situation was when we met. There's a lot of extra content that kind of comes along with it, some other lick builder videos and other stuff. But the main drive is the songs that I've used. But in fact, the new one we're going to release, I think it's probably going to be tomorrow, is I did a Danger Danger tune called Beat the Bullet from the second Danger Danger record. It's probably my most requested.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys showed me how to play that solo on Beat the Bullet, so people like that one for whatever reason. It's flashy and it's melodic. So that's going to be one of the songs of the month, which is the first time I've done a Danger Danger song. It's all just been Andy Timmons band and solo stuff in mind. So that's an ongoing, thing I'm always creating content for. I've got a lot of people that sign up for it and enjoy the after.
Yeah, I may do that.
Stage gigs every Saturday at 2 p.m. and 8 p.m. CST. But it's different every time. Sometimes I'll do a show. Mm-hmm. Last week, 2 weekends ago, I did Jimi Hendrix for an hour, one of the slots, and then Danger Danger for the other slot. So next week, I'm going to get back to doing stuff on my own records. But I like to branch out and do covers sometimes, you know.
I think it's so awesome that you guys are doing that, you know, and, you know, there's a lot of guys doing instructional stuff now. Billy Cobham does, you know, drums.
Awesome.
Lee Oscar, I just talked to, and he's got a harmonica thing going on, you know. It's crazy. I love it.
Well, the beauty, too, I think for all of us, I think the players that are doing some of these video contests, it's like, well, you know, we're not here forever, and it'll be nice. It'll be nice to have these documents of, hey, if you like the music, here's how it was done.
Exactly.
You know, and for us to be able to do it while we can still do it, you know.
Exactly.
Like, God forbid, you know. So it's I think it's kind of valuable in that way as well. So it'll always be there for those in the future that might want to dig into the, you know, how did that happen?
I put a book out. It was just published. It's called the Rockstar Chronicles. I got over 45 intimate conversations with all the legends.
Wow.
And it's for that reason. It's not for the money. It's for the new generations coming up to find out what these guys were like, you know?
It is important, man. So thank you for putting that out. It is that kind of thing, like when Tommy Tedesco's son put together that Wrecking Crew movie about all the session.
Oh, that was great.
You know, a lot of them are already passed on now since the film was done. So it's so great to get these stories that might be lost when those people move on, you know. So there's so many just great, you know, things that happen during the sessions are little behind the scenes things that, you know, become really important. Like, because those songs have been with us for so many years now, they will continue to be enjoyed and inspire future generations. It's great to get those stories from the people that were there that did it. It's so valuable.
That's why I do what I do, man. I love doing what I'm doing.
Beautiful contribution, man. Thank you for doing what you do.
Well, we're going to add you to... I'm going to do 4 series of the book. So we're going to add you in probably the next series, if that's okay with you.
I'd be honored, man. Absolutely.
Yeah, that'll be wonderful.
Yeah.
Andy, I want to thank you so much, man, for being on the show today. You're
thank
an incredible
you
guitar player. I look forward to you touring, and hopefully you'll come to Florida when this is all over.
Absolutely, man. I've made many great memories in the state of Florida.
Awesome. And keep up the great work. We'll all be listening. And, of course, Theme from a Perfect World, your latest. And
yep.
I give it 5 stars, and it's available at Amazon.com.
I appreciate you very much, Ray.
All right, man. Take care, and my best to you and your family.
You as well, man. Stay safe out there.
All right, Andy. Take care, man.
Bye, brother.
Bye-bye.
Take care, bud. Bye.
Purchase the most recent album by Andy Timmons' band entitled Theme from a Perfect World. Available at Amazon.com. 5 stars all the way. You're going to love this album. For more information about Andy Timmons, visit www.andytimmons.com. Andy's on Facebook, www.facebook.com/AndyTimmonsOfficial. Also, the Guitar Experience, www.guitarexperience.net. Also on Twitter, Andy's on Twitter, www.twitter.com/AndyTimmonsBand. Very special thanks, of course, to Andy Timmons for arranging this interview and the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsom of VBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of interviewing the legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, please contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com and please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. It's real news, people. And, of course, my new book, finally out, entitled The Rockstar Chronicles, Series 1. It chronicles truths, confessions, and wisdom from the music legends that set us all free. Order yours today on hardcover or ebook. The collector's edition hardcover at bookbaby.com. It features over 45 intimate conversations with some of the greatest rock legends the world will ever know. God bless you. Have a great week and stay safe, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on PBS Radio, Station 1.